Okay, we might make a start. We've got Julie Phillips here from the Disability Discrimination Legal Service to provide us with some information in relation to people with disabilities and their interaction with the justice system. Julie's got over 20 years' experience in the community sector, and she's, for anyone that knows her, they know the passion that she has. She has a keen interest in disability and is very interested in the issues facing people with disabilities. She's the CEO of the Disability Discrimination Legal Service. She's a colleague of mine and sits on the Disability Advocacy Victoria board. And I'm pleased to welcome her here today to the conference, and I hope you enjoy this session. Thanks, Julie.
Thanks. Thanks, everyone. I wish I was the CEO. That sounds so much better than manager, doesn't it? Thank you, Melanie. Thank you. I've got some slides. I haven't timed them. I hope we all finish in time. But I like to ask people that if they have a question, particularly if they're not quite sure of what I'm saying, that you might want to interrupt or put your hand up then and there, because by the time we get to the end, which is 50 minutes away, you might think, oh, what was that I wanted to say? So we have someone with a microphone up there. See this guy here holding it up? And so if you do have a question, if you wouldn't mind putting up your hand, then we'll make sure the microphone gets to you. So my presentation today is on people with disabilities and their involvement in the criminal justice system. Now, do we have anyone with a hearing loss here that needs more assistance than they're getting at the moment? Nope, anyone needs to move down the front to get closer? And I've got some hard copies here and the font is quite large. I'm not an expert in this area, but there's so much research around. If you Google some of this stuff, it's hard. There's so much research around, it's hard to decide which bits to adopt. So I just wanted to say that, so if you're going to ask me about some of the research that I put up here, there's no way I'll be able to answer you probably. So, I mean, the first question is there a link between having a disability and being involved in the criminal justice system? And unfortunately, there is. And it's not because there's an inherent part of a disability that makes someone be a criminal. So if you look in the DSM-5, you won't find criminality as a symptom of any disability. So what is it? I guess we're here to talk about what is it, what are these links? Now, I've done exactly the opposite of to what I was told to do with my PowerPoints, which is to only have a few words on each one. But I'm wanting to quote other people. So here's a quote from some research which says, "What is known is that those with disabilities, particularly mental disorders, are overrepresented within the criminal justice system, and rates of mental health issues are at least 3 times higher for those who enter the criminal justice system prior to adulthood than those of the general population." I was also told to use simple English, and when you're quoting research, that's impossible. So if I can't even be understood, please interrupt me as well. Here's some more research. Individuals with ASDs, which are autism spectrum disorders, are 7 times more likely to experience contact with the criminal justice sector than the general population. And that's from a paper called The Prevalence and Treatment of People with Asperger's Syndrome in the Criminal Justice System. And look, obviously I'm just picking out the odd sentence. They're all very interesting papers. And now we'll look at perhaps language disorder. This paper presents evidence from Australia and overseas that demonstrates that high proportions, some 50% in Australian studies, of young offenders have a clinically significant but previously undetected oral language disorder. So a lot of the research I'm talking about isn't necessarily Australian, because we don't spit it out as much as other countries do. This particular one is, and it's from the paper Youth in Justice, Oral Language Competence in Early Life. Then we'll move on to ADHD. Studies show that at least 25% of prisoners in the US have ADHD. The recidivism rate, which means going back into jail after you've already committed a crime once, amongst all felons is high, and an estimated two-thirds are rearrested within about 3 years. And these statistics have important implications for society at large. So far, after just picking just a few of the hundreds of papers on this topic, we've got a link between a certain cohort of disabilities and criminal justice. So mental health problems, which is really broad, cognitive disabilities, autism spectrum disorder, language disorder, and ADHD. I'm guessing that the autism spectrum disorder link is probably towards the higher end of autism spectrum disorder. So it's interesting, without even me actually looking into other specific disabilities, these things just popped up very quickly and immediately. And so I guess one of the questions is, what is the connection? And are there commonalities between the disabilities that we just had on the slide that make this involvement in the criminal justice system more common? Now, one of the big connectors is illiteracy, and so not being able to read and write. So several studies have shown crime and education are inextricably tied together, and that factors like level of achievement in school, student grade retention, school attendance, and graduation rates are related to criminal activity. So illiteracy is probably something that these disabilities might have in common. Not again, because they are an inherent part of the disability. We all know now, because there's enough studies, that people with intellectual disabilities can be taught to read and write using evidence-based programs. And even those with moderate to severe intellectual disabilities can be taught to read and write. So it's a concern that illiteracy is actually even still an issue. But there's a clear link between that and criminal activity. And here's another complicated quote. Yeah.
Just on that illiteracy issue, is it the actual illiteracy, or is it that people are situated in their community or their society such that the education system as a whole fails them and their families fail them? So it's not the actual illiteracy. The illiteracy is like a pointer to some
yes.
other more important factors.
Yes, that's right. And just in a few slides, I'll go into that in more detail. And look, nothing simple, is it? Everything's linked to something else, which is linked to something else. But yes, that's the answer to your question. So somebody called Putnam's maintained there is a general agreement in the research literature that delinquency is associated with poor educational achievement, particularly poor literacy. The author stated that this relationship has become so widely accepted that there is a belief that literacy problems are widespread amongst offenders and that literacy deficits are a major cause of crime. And if you think about it, which is not on a particular slide that I've got, think about bullying, for example, just the issue of bullying in schools and how that affects particularly boys, because I think boys probably cop it a bit more than girls. I know girls do are subjected to bullying, and I'm talking about disabilities now. But you can turn into a very angry child if you are bullied. And, you know, again, talking about things linking in, bullying in children with Asperger's, for example, there's been books written about that, of the high rates of bullying those kids are susceptible to. So if you're bullied constantly and it's not addressed, you've probably also heard that people can then become bullies, but they're very angry, as is understandable. And so that's not going to help life generally. And that's from a paper called Crime Can Be Prevented If Schools Teach Juvenile Offenders to Read. And then several theories have emerged to explain the overrepresentation of youth with disabilities in correction and detention facilities. These include school failure, susceptibility, differential treatment, and metacognitive deficits. And we're talking mostly, I guess, about guys, boys, young men. My experience of illiteracy in girls in schools, they tend to just get, and these are generalisations, tend to get a bit more depressed and withdraw, whereas boys tend to start acting up, and then there becomes this circular problem where they start acting up to get attention because they can't, they're not learning. They attract negative comments from the teacher, they get angrier, it gets worse and worse. Detentions, suspensions, expulsions. If anyone works in that area, that will be familiar to them. The school failure theory asserts that learning, emotional, behavioural and intellectual disabilities lead either directly to school failure or transactionally to school problems and failure causing negative self-image, so bad self-esteem, which in turn leads to school dropout, suspension and delinquency. And we all know that suspensions and expulsions do actually nothing to assist the child. They might help. They might seem an answer to schools to get rid of a problem, but the child then just has to enrol somewhere else because you have to. And sometimes kids are suspended and expelled from numerous schools in a row. So here we've got you've got your disability factor, and then you've got this strong link with education, and then you've got that linking with crime. And this could also probably be a circle rather than just these arrows, but I couldn't work out how to do a circle, so I put it like that. And so if we don't think this is satisfactory, and I don't think anyone does, we have to, rather than just me have a talk about it and everyone go, oh dear, this is really bad, I think it's worthwhile thinking about what is causing it. Some of these academics are interesting. They produce some very interesting research papers, and then they're off to the next research paper and the next research paper. But all this research doesn't really help us at all unless we do something with it and we somehow apply what we're learning through research to real life. And so it's interesting because I do work outside of the Disability Discrimination Legal Service, and I've actually seen some of the clients that I had a few years ago, boys, end up in jail about 4 or 5 years later, because their parents tend to contact me for referrals to people to help them defend charges. So the theory of these academics, if you work in the field, you can test it out because you can see it, and you can see that you were advocating for this child and their school, and they didn't end up getting what they wanted. And then 4 to 5 years later, they're in that unit at Port Phillip. And interestingly, I can't remember what the unit's called at Port Phillip, but it's for people with intellectual disability and learning disorders. Marlborough? It's actually got some good good services. You shouldn't have to go to jail for good services.
Hi. Yes, I think I was in the at that jail way back. And I think they have got good prison systems for people with disability who goes probably end up in that area. And they helped me to to stay out, or hopefully stay out of trouble. And God, I did stay out of trouble now and doing the right thing since I got out.
Right. Well, as I said, and there's also another school. It's not really a school. I think it's Parkville that the Department of Education set up for juvenile offenders. Emmy's nodding her head. And that seemed really good. But again, you know, the whole point of research is to try and do preventative stuff. So it's good having these good programs and nice jail units to assist people with disabilities. But I'm often flabbergasted as to why we... it's a bit like the building a whole lot of new jails when we don't put as much time and money into working out how to prevent crime. And I don't mean... more police, I mean, what are the causes of crime? And you know, which is what we're speaking about today. And then trying to do something to prevent it happening in the first place. But we don't seem to learn very well, I don't think. So going back to the illiteracy connection, do we have a problem competently teaching students with disabilities in our schools? Well, we do. That's all right, you can say that. We do, and... we've got now the Victorian Equal Opportunity and Human Rights Commission report, the Held Back report, which was 2012, which was a very, I think it was about 300 pages, a very lengthy report on those problems. And we also had the Victorian Auditor General's Office producing a report at the same time. One was a qualitative report and one was a quantitative report. I have great trouble saying those. So one was looking at numbers and figures and one was looking at quality. And at the Disability Discrimination Legal Service, and we are a very, very small service, and we provide services to the state of Victoria, well, we're meant to provide services to the state of Victoria. The most common respondent to discrimination complaints and inquiries is the Department of Education. And we find that ironic because we get government, we're a non-government organisation, but we receive government money mostly through the Commonwealth, to put a lot of effort into discrimination caused by government. I've always found that's a bit ironic. And as a member of the Disability Advocacy Victoria, who are partly running this conference, we organised some gathering of statistics and data recently, and we're the peak body for all the independent advocacy agencies in Victoria. And education issues were the most common complaints. So we're disability advocacy, just on disability. So there's, I guess, four examples that support the fact that we do have difficulties competently teaching kids with disabilities, which goes back to the illiteracy issue. And so if you have time to read the Equal Opportunity Commission report, it's a long one. I don't think I've quite got there yet, but I'm really summarising here. So some of the issues are these. Attitude. A lot of principals, parents come to me and say that the principal said to me, look, we just don't have the resources to assist your child. But I think what they were really saying is we don't want them because they're not really allowed to say that. So students with disabilities often require resources that schools don't have and that the Department of Education doesn't provide, so they're not welcome. So it may not be necessarily that a principal is just a nasty person. They might be thinking, oh, my God, when we had Johnny last year, he needed an aide, we couldn't get funding, it was a terrible experience, I had two teachers on stress leave, I can't go through that again, I'm just going to put them off. And students with disabilities often require expertise that teachers don't have and that the Department of Education doesn't provide, resulting in ongoing problems, so they're not welcome. So the Department of Education has a limited number of speech pathologists and psychologists, but for kids who have very complex disabilities, autism spectrum disorder, for example, combinations of... I've got a client at the moment who has about 5 disabilities, all cognitive. They are, you know, they need some expertise, which is often outside, and people have to be paid to come in and assist and support teachers. And we shouldn't be expecting teachers to be experts in disability, because of course they're not. They learn teaching, they do a little bit of disability in their teaching course. But clearly there are some kids who need a greater level of expertise to successfully address the barriers their disability poses. The other issue is that there's no requirement for teachers to use any particular programs. And the Department of Education policies and procedures require evidence-based interventions, but teachers and principals don't know what these are. So often when you ask the question, they actually don't know. And look, that's not their fault. Evidence and science changes all the time, and to know what is evidence-based, what is effective, particularly linked with particular disabilities, you've got to keep up with everything. And therefore, if they are not kept up to date, they're not going to know. And if you listen to teachers talk about their workload and all the work they've got to do out of their teaching time, this is probably just one more thing they need some assistance with. And so the lack of guidance that they get covers both academic practices, so in other words, which literacy and numeracy remedial programs have an evidence base, and what are evidence-based interventions for disability. So you've got education, disability, and of course they both form one issue. So that's why you might get teachers doing reading recovery 3 years in a row, which is only a program for grade one, because they haven't been told. No one's supervising them and saying, no, that's not going to work. There's policies that talk about school-wide positive behaviour support, but a lot of the teachers don't know what that means. So they really need a bit more guidance and support so they can successfully address the impediments that the disabilities cause. And when I say impediments, I don't think a disability causes an inability to learn. Well, it doesn't matter what I think. The evidence is that people with disabilities can learn, and therefore that's why I talk about impediments, not the person's impediments. Perhaps barriers is a better word. What are the barriers in between this person with a disability and them learning? The other issue is autonomy. Principals can run their schools in any manner they please, and of course they've got to follow basic guidelines, they've got to teach properly, although community schools, they're interesting. If anyone's had any experience with them, they have a very fluid arrangement. But basically in terms of programs, how they spend money, what sort of people they get in, each principal has the authority to do whatever they like in that regard. And the other thing that the Commission and the Auditor General found, that there's no across-the-board training in writing individual education plans, which are the backbone, I guess, of teaching people to students with disabilities a plan. They don't really know who to contact or what to do when faced with challenging behaviours, and they don't know how to run a student support group or that they have to. And again, the Department of Education actually has some really good documents regarding these things, but often they're not, teachers aren't familiar with them. So these are the things that these two state bodies found. So, problems. Okay, what are some other factors that could be involved as well? Now, the Equal Opportunity Commission did a one chapter on restraint and seclusion. My experience is that it is used prolifically, particularly in special schools. Seclusion is just shutting a kid in a room. They can't get out, or they think they can't get out. And the Auditor General also, I think he only had about 5 or 6 recommendations, but one of them was to do with restraint. And so restraint and seclusion result in trauma and worsening behaviours. And again, I won't ask you to take my word for it. So the Commission, I'm just quoting part of their report, educators, so teachers also anonymously called in and spoke to the Commission as well, and parents reported restraint and seclusion of students. Many educators, so teachers, reported that they were inadequately trained to deal with the situation. And this is what I mean. Of course they are. Of course they are. And the Commission found there is no independent oversight or monitoring of the use of seclusion and restraint in Victorian schools. There is no official data on how frequently these practices occur in schools, why they are used, or their impacts. And the most recent notification I had of physical restraint on a little girl with a photo of an injury was last night. So, recommendations. Both the Equal Opportunity Commission and the Office of the Public Advocate have recommended that the Department of Education hand over its regulation of restrictive practices to the Office of the Senior Practitioner. Do you know who he is? Office of the Senior Practitioner? So the Office of the Senior Practitioner is part of DHS, and there were changes to the Disability Act in Disability Act, gosh, 4 or 5 years ago? 2006. And there are actually quite a lot of there's quite a lot of regulation about the use of restrictive practices on adults, and the Office of the Senior Practitioner is, even though I say it's part of DHS, it's kind of, it falls under DHS, but it's kind of separate. So if you want to use restrictive practices on an adult with a disability, you've got to jump through hoops, as you should. You've got to prove you've done a comprehensive behaviour assessment. You've got to try other things. You've got to ask for permission to use restrictive practices. And the Office of the Senior Practitioner has put out a lot of really good booklets about restrictive practices. And so far, the Department of Education have not agreed to that recommendation. Now, you often find special schools and mainstream saying, well, these children are out of control, they're violent, they're aggressive. A lot of unfortunate language used. And we all know that if you work in the disability sector, that there are disabilities like autism spectrum disorder where if you're not careful, children will experience challenging behaviours. The research also tells us that there are interventions that address those, psychological interventions and behavioural analysis interventions, which address these sorts of things. What research does exist indicates that for the majority of those patients who have been secluded or restrained, it was not beneficial and in fact was a noxious experience, so a really bad experience. And that's out of a hospital setting, because restraint and seclusion often happens in, I guess, two main areas. Well, actually, I'm thinking three now. Schools, community residential units, institutions, psychiatric institutions. And the issues are the same, probably worse if you're a child, really. The use of seclusion and restraint on persons with mental health and or addictive disorders has resulted in deaths and serious physical injury and psychological trauma. And that's from a book, School Is Not Supposed to Hurt, which a group of disability agencies in the US got together and wrote and set out the deaths that had occurred on kids with disabilities in schools from restrictive practices. Psychological and psychiatric organisations have come to realise that restraint and seclusion are harmful to children. While some psychological effects may be short-term, such as fear and adrenaline rush, constant physical confrontation may lead to long-term effects such as post-traumatic stress disorder. A study asking students to draw pictures of their seclusion indicated that they saw it as a form of punishment. The pictures showed students crying and calling for help. So this is all bad news, and it is occurring. And so when you're traumatised from restrictive practices, you then, even if you didn't have one before, have a mental health problem, which puts you back into the risk factor again. So you can see it's a big circle. All these things are joined up. And so again, because I couldn't do my circle, I did my arrows. So then you've got disability, violence against the child. And restraint is violent. We've had, you know, three teachers sitting on kids on the floor. Mental health problems, crime. So can something be done? Yes. And look, if it's not obviously clear straight away that this is something to be fixed, I mean, there was so much research on restrictive practices, obviously, there's no way I could put it in, but it also is traumatic for the teachers, the people doing the restraint. It is also traumatic for them. And they often develop difficulties as well because I don't think, well, I would know, wouldn't I? I don't know if anyone's ever been involved in trying to restrain someone who's trying to hurt you, even if it's a child, or if you've ever been hit, even accidentally. It's really quite upsetting. And actually, I can remember once I was shut in between a door and a wall by someone who was just so upset she wanted to leave the room so quickly. I was kind of in the way and I was sandwiched. And I knew she didn't do it on purpose. And in fact, she was so upset 10 minutes later. She came back and she was hugging me and she was saying she was sorry. So there wasn't any malice towards me at all. But it was a real shock to me to have that happen. So if you're shutting children in rooms when they're screaming and crying and kicking, if you're literally physically holding kids on the ground who are struggling and trying to get away, it is damaging to those people as well. And so, and we all know, I have a friend who's a teacher, or she was a teacher and went on work cover and left the system due to having a kid with a disability in her class that wasn't funded. And, you know, to cut a long story short, it was so stressful that she ended up leaving. And when she did leave, the child got an aid, but it was a bit too late for her. So as you can see, there's good reasons all around to address some of these problems. You've got the mental health of students and the well-being. You've got their education. You've got the mental health and well-being of teachers. You've got the criminal justice system. So we can't just talk about these things like we're doing today, in my opinion, without thinking, okay, well, what shall we do? So we've already had a lot of recommendations made about what needs to happen to improve the ability of schools to address kids with disabilities. And while the Auditor-General only made about five recommendations, I think the Commission made about, 50? I don't know. Anyone chip in? I think the Human Rights Commission, I don't see them as being a very radical body. If you look at the recommendations, they're mostly pretty sensible. Those of us in various groups that network with each other are concerned because while meetings might be occurring, we can't see any changes happening on the ground yet.
I'd like to know who educates the educators to do a better job.
Well, look, I usually don't have a lot of praise for Christopher Pine. However, he has just made two very sensible appointments to this body, whose name escapes me. But look, I think you might also be familiar with the fact that there's also been a lot of research in the last couple of years about the fact that to be a teacher, you can even fail and still get in. There's been a lot of criticism in the newspapers, which is probably hard for teachers who love their job to read and digest, but about the fact that you don't have to get very high marks to be a teacher. And when you think about it, teaching children is probably one of the most important things you can do. And teaching children with disabilities, apart from being important, it obviously requires a lot of skill as well. So these discussions have been taking place, and I think that's over the last 5 years, I think it's probably fair to say. Christopher Pine has put in, got you Amanda, put in two people. One is John Hattie, I think, and the other guy is John Fleming. Now these might not mean much to people who aren't educationalists, but John Fleming worked in, I hope I'm getting them around the right way, worked in a primary school in Heidelberg, and by using evidence-based literacy programs, got this, I mean, you can imagine, it could have even been West Heidelberg, poor socioeconomic area, really doing badly in educational achievement. He comes in, he changes the whole thing and turns the whole school around. So all of a sudden these kids are achieving. It was very exciting. Unfortunately, Haileybury then snapped him up. But he is a pioneer in relation to evidence-based education. So I guess we're all hoping that something will happen in terms of the training of teachers, but it is certainly something that is being discussed ad nauseam at the moment. So that's a good thing. And I think behind you had a question.
Tell me what they on what basis did the Department of Education refuse to hand over its powers dealing with restrictive practices to
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, it's probably not normal for one department to hand over regulation of what it's doing in a small area to another. But I think that that recommendation was made is because there is currently no alternative that is there. There is no prohibition on seclusion. In other words, there's no rules against seclusion in government schools. And there's no one you have to check with before you start implementing those practices. So I think that's why these two bodies made that recommendation, but I guess I don't know. Amanda. Oh, sorry, Amanda, can you wait for the mic? Microphone? It's coming.
Hi, my name is Amanda Heathcote, and something just hit me in the head and it's got my ears flying back and forth. On the Dr. Phil program, which is American, and he's a mandate person to go to the authorities about kids getting bullied and all that. They have such laws here in Australia.
Well, look, we've got occupational health and safety laws. We've got, I'm just trying to think of anything else that mentions bullying, the Disability Discrimination Act. But the thing about bullying, as with other things, is that a lot of schools have a reactive policy, or what I call a shallow policy, just say no. It was a bit like that, if anyone's old enough to remember Nancy Reagan and her anti-drugs thing, just say no. And says, oh, okay, well, that fixes the drug problem. In this great book about Asperger's and bullying, it talks about a whole lot of preventative programs that the US has in place. And look, the US, it's not nirvana. It often has some really fantastic practice and some really bad practice. But they've got a lot of really good preventative programs about bullying. So the idea is that you have in your school all these programs, you're learning about bullying, whether it happens or not. And so there's theatre plays, there's really fun programs that help kids in school learn about bullying and why it's not good. What I've seen a lot of here is things called, here's what we do if bullying, firstly, bullying is not on. Okay. Here's what we do if bullying happens. We have restorative practices, which means we get everyone together for a chat. And so that's all right. But again, let's go to the other side. What programs can we put in place that stop, that creates a culture that stops it from even happening? And so that's what I'd like to see. And the other thing that I've seen a lot of is children reporting bullying and the teachers saying to the parents, well, I didn't see it, or I asked Peter if he said that thing to Johnny and he said he didn't, and I think it's just his perception of bullying. So that seems disappointing as well, that kids are not always believed. So that's my long answer. And did you have another question in the orange shirt? Sorry.
I did, but I've forgotten now.
Oh, sorry.
But you finally touched on it. I worked in a school for 7 years as an aide, and everything you've described I've seen in action, and it was appalling. Two things. And I worked with children with autism. Any time I saw a teacher approach a child with autism in a fashion like you would treat a dog, wanting to injure and harm and bully, the dog would come out snapping and fighting. So I saw all that. So my question before about how do you educate the educators, who does that? When's that going to start? Because they don't really want to know. And the other thing that happened in this school, not in the city, in the country, the hierarchy in the school were bullies. Once you take the bullies out of the system, the children are not bullies. And I witnessed that happen. The bully wasn't the principal of the school. It was a woman who had a really important position, and she influenced other teachers to become bullies. Once that changed, the children, it was a lovely school. Change can happen.
And this is probably going back to the silo issue with the schools. Sometimes parents I know contact regional officers, and the regional officers say, I've got you next, Mark, we can't tell the principal what to do. And so, I guess unless it was just so a huge breach in policy, I'm sure something could happen then. But generally speaking, the way the principal runs the school is the way it runs the school. And in terms of who's teaching them, I guess this goes back to that umbrella thing again about guidance that's needed and more direction that's needed with these people, because there are evidence-based interventions that are academic and that are behavioural. They are usually not being used. Who's telling them to use them? Who's educating, as you say, the educators? Well, it seems the answer probably is no one at the moment. I know that there are documents that are available for teachers on the web. Whether they read them or not is kind of up to them. Even the autism schools don't use the only established evidence-based intervention for autism. It's something that we should keep talking about because it's a big problem. Mark?
Thanks, Julie. Mark Figan, Office of the Public Advocate. I've been with you in a courtroom where, you know, the education system was on trial in a way. That's not how the proceedings are conducted, but that's kind of what I saw happening, and it wasn't a good look for the education system, and you're showing us again its failings. But my question or my comment is more about how that is, I think, a symptom of wider failings. Like, the education system is letting down people with disabilities in a serious, harmful way. But they're not alone. If you look at the prison population, it depends on what measures you use, but if you assess for acquired brain injury or brain injury, you'll find that roughly half the prison population has an acquired brain injury. And most of those prisoners with a brain injury would have gone through mainstream schools without a disability and might have a university degree. You know, they acquired an injury after the education system, so we can't blame the education system for them being in prison. It's something else has gone wrong.
Mm.
And the something else that's gone wrong is often disability services or the mainstream supports you'd look to for to support people so that when they're in crisis, they didn't look at crime as a solution to their problems or their support needs were met and they don't end up in jail or they don't go back to jail. So we've got a big problem here, part of it in the education system and part of how our supports it widely are letting down people with disability to the point where we're wasting $63,000 per annum to support a prisoner or to lock someone up at the minimum, I think, more than that, when maybe a more sensible investment, we would all be at a happier place.
Yeah, and look, we could talk all day, couldn't we, Mark, about the different areas of disability services. I guess one of the reasons I'm passionate about children is because it's the start of your life, and if that's all stuffed up, you know, you're in trouble. But when I was here, so we've got Red Lady in the corner, then Sharon. When I was here a couple of years ago at the last conference, I was talking about activism and the lack thereof, in my humble opinion, going on here in Victoria. And I think when you talk about court, Mark, parents, if you can imagine, are pushed to the absolute limit before they decide to do such a thing. And it's sometimes I've seen families try and negotiate for 1 or 2 years with schools and the department and do it unsuccessfully. So clearly we've got to do talking like this conference, but then everyone goes away. I think we've all got to think more about these issues and think about working strategically together to address them, because talking's not going to cut it. And we know what some of the issues are. And we know how to fix them.
I think sometimes we forget the most basic unit in our society is the family. And if families need support, they need support and education in how to help their child with a disability. And when that child goes into a school, they need to be able to have a positive partnership with the school. And I've had various children at various levels of school, and it's okay to say you don't restrain the child, but when your child is in a classroom and is throwing computers and is hitting, there has to be some type of restraint. But the ability of the teacher to read the child before it gets to that point is often reflected by the ability of the parents to teach that teacher what their child needs are and what their what to put in before it gets to that point. And often that is really overlooked. Teachers don't often want to listen to parents. Parents are often intimidated about going into schools and teaching.
Yeah, and they're really good points. Parents often don't know the answers either, because they're not experts in disability either, and they don't know what the latest psychological interventions are. They don't know how to write up a positive behaviour plan. And I think it's an indictment on the whole system that it's almost set up to cause friction between teachers and parents. And all parents and teachers, I'm assuming that's got to be the case, want a good, constructive relationship. But to give a very simple example, if your child who's deaf needs an Auslan interpreter and the school say they can't afford one, they're not getting the money to be able to afford one, and then the child comes home crying every day, and then the mum keeps going and saying, what are you doing, get me the Auslan interpreter, tensions start to rise, arguments start to happen, and it's a recipe for disaster. So that's why we've got to look at the issue in a very broad way, because as I said, it's not helpful for teachers or parents. Sharon, and then you.
Following on from what Laddie in the Orange was saying, the who's educating the educators, one of the things that always concerns me is that we employ teachers' aides to assist the child with a disability. The teacher's aide is usually the least qualified person at the school, but is expected to work and challenge the child with the disability who has the most challenging needs, and it somehow absolves the classroom teacher. And I think we've just got around the wrong way. The teacher's aide actually needs to be more skilled in lots of ways to work with the child with a disability or the student with a disability.
Yeah, look, that's true as well. And the microphone's coming down to this lady in the purple. And it's an issue that's been highlighted, and it's probably got to do with money, I guess. AIDS only need a working with children check. AIDS can work very well under structured programs. I'm thinking, for example, kids with severe language disorder that need a speech pathologist to devise a speech pathology program. There was one particular one, I can't remember the name of it, but it was a whole system where speech pathologists were designing programs for kids with language disorders, training the aide in how to do it, collect data. And in that circumstance, when the aide has got the support and the supervision, and she was regularly supervised by the speechie, that worked really well. Similarly, one of my clients in my other job, who was described here, and getting back to the comment about restraint and seclusion, what the Office of the Senior Practitioner says is this: if someone has a meltdown and adult or child and lashes out and is going to hurt someone, you might have to restrain them. But after that, you know that there's a likelihood that that might happen again. And so you immediately do a planned response, which is a comprehensive behaviour assessment and analysis and a behaviour plan and psychologists, etc. There should not be a need to repeat it, because if there is, something about your plan is not working. So I was about to say, in terms of AIDS and qualifications, one of my kids who was restrained and secluded quite a bit was described as violent and aggressive and didn't have had very few independent abilities. The family moved and went overseas, and the child now does the shopping once a week on his own in the shop. He has his own wallet. I've seen the videos of him. It is unbelievable. And he has a behaviour therapist working with him, particularly when he first started, supervised by a board-certified behaviour analyst. And so for some kids, we're looking at a huge sophistication needed to address these problems. And his life is just completely different. So it is difficult with AIDS because, look, some of them are terrific, but, of course, they need support and guidance and training too. So it all comes back to this support and structure and learning. Thank you. I'm so sorry.
No, that's all right. Fiona from Grampians Disability Advocacy. Hi, Julie. Sorry for the referrals. I just wanted to touch on the parents and the lack of resources. One of the recurring themes I seem to be getting is that parents are ignored as a resource. Quite often they are the expert in their child's behaviour, and they're just not utilised. Quite often they're actually offering the resources with the positive behaviour plan assessments, and again, they're ignored by the schools. So it's a failure to recognise the resources that are also that are already there.
No, that's true. And Christian over here, that's true. And look, some parents do have really good ideas, and department policy actually says in the student support group guidelines, parents should have their views valued, and sometimes that happens, sometimes it doesn't. And I think in the end, you know, if it's a perfect consideration, then everyone's working in the best interest of the child. Now, I've got you and you, and then we better finish because I'm going to run over. Christian.
Yeah, basically, what I would like to say, I think the system is completely wrong from the basic of it. Because if we've got a system where we have private school and public school. Now, if you look at the private system, most people with a disability or anyone who needs support will never be able to get into a private school. So it sounds like all the responsibility is given to the public system, and we create two categories, basically, of people. People who are going to get opportunities in their life if they go to a private school, and people who are not going to get much opportunity if they go to a public school system. I think the solution to that will be if both systems work together rather than trying to be in competition somehow.
Yeah, and private schools often don't like kids with disabilities because they like to be able to boast at the end of the year how high their marks are or how many people got such and such, and they worry that they'll be dragged down by kids with disabilities. And look, we all know that public schools educate most of us, and they've got to be provided with the money to do so. So with a principal with a global budget who has to think, gee, this kid didn't get funding but he needs a full-time aide, that's $45,000, but there's 20 holes in my roof and it's leaking, which one will I do? It's we can criticise, but it's not a fair situation to be in, is it? So public schools, I'm a big supporter of public schools, but they've got to be supported properly. And this will be the last question.
Hi, I got a son who's going to start school next year. And as I said, it's not at my place. I got him on weekends. But I'm afraid he may, with the people who got him at the moment, he's not tempting at home on anything. And I'm scared when he starts school, he may be bullied or get like behind from the school system.
Yeah, well, maybe you can ask the school what bullying programs they've got in place. So I don't mean what they do after someone's been bullied, but what they do and encourage them to put in bullying programs all the time throughout the school year. And look, sometimes in terms of schools, talk to other parents. There's a good grapevine. If you've got someone with a good attitude leading the school, that is really great. Even if they don't have the money, they do their best. I think I've only got a couple more slides left anyway. So what are the good reasons for people with disabilities to be educated, as if it's not obvious? Well, firstly, it's their right to be educated. Secondly, they can get jobs and they can become contributing members of the community. Do you remember the PricewaterhouseCooper report that came out a couple of years ago and said, were we the worst or the second? People with disabilities were in the second or worst level of poverty in the developed world, or some terrible statistic. I've probably got that quite wrong. So we want people with disabilities to have a good future. Economically, it makes sense. Whoever talked about the money going into something or other when it should be going into this. If you look at some of the economic studies, you know, you get a job, you can pay tax, you're not getting the pension, and look what's happening now. You've got threats of the disability support pension, impossible tasks for some people with disabilities who aren't on the pension but have to might have to apply for 40 jobs per week. So you've got the squeeze on the pensions, but a lot of kids with disabilities could get tertiary education and get jobs if they had a good education. So there's an economic argument, which shouldn't be our main argument, but there is a good economic argument as to why money should go into education. And of course there's equality and non-discrimination, and according to the research, we'll have less crime. So we might not have to build the next jail. If we took all the people with disabilities out of it, you know, we'd have a great saving there. So how do we achieve all that wish list? Well, we really do need to work at it, guys. You're all members of organisations. You need to encourage them to take these things up and liaise with each other in terms of a plan of how to address them. Because I'm sure you're as sick as I am of reading reports about the socioeconomic status of people with disabilities, how much money they don't have, the quality of their lives, they can't get an education. We need to stop just reading these reports and talking to ourselves about them and really planning as to what we can do about it. And as I said, in terms of this topic, it's good for children, teachers, families. There's not a bad thing about educating kids and keeping them out of jail. Thank you for listening.